Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Beirut, Lebanon, to speak with Rami Khoury, who's a Palestinian, Jordanian, and U.S. citizen who resides in his family resides in Beirut, Amman, and Nazareth. He is an internationally syndicated political columnist and author. His writing has been distributed by Agence Global, and Rami Khoury is the director of the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut and the editor-at-large of the Beirut-based Daily Star and the co-laureate of the 2006 Pax Christi International Peace Award. And he'll be joining us in a moment to talk about the political crisis in Lebanon, a country without a president and a country that many people feel is on the brink of a renewed civil war after having recovered from a 15-year-long civil war in the 80s. Then we'll be joined by Dr. Chris Fair, who's a research associate at the senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace at their Center for Global Analysis and Prevention. She specializes in South Asian political and military affairs, and her research concerns the security competition between India and Pakistan, Pakistan's internal security, the analysis of the causes of terrorism, and the U.S. strategic relations with India and Pakistan. She's now a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, and she's just returned from Afghanistan, where she was a political officer with the United Nations Assistant Mission to Afghanistan. So we'll be talking to her both about Pakistan and Afghanistan. And then we'll speak with Dr. Benjamin Barber, a distinguished senior fellow at Demos, a New York progressive think tank for ideas and action. He is the author of the prescient book, Jihad versus McWorld, and his new book is Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. And we're talking to him about the consumption frenzy that will be seen and experienced for the next month up until Christmas, of course, the day after Thanksgiving being Black Friday, the day where the stores open their doors at midnight and people consume, jostle, and fight over goods that they may really not need at the end of the day. So we'll be talking to Ben Barber about the consumption mania in this country. I'm now speaking with Rami Khoury, as I mentioned, who's a Palestinian-Jordanian U.S. citizen. His family resides in Beirut, Amman, and Nazareth. He's an internationally syndicated political columnist and author. He's writing distributed by Agence Global, and he's also the director of the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut and editor-at-large of the Beirut-based Daily Star and the co-laureate of the 2006 Pax Christi International Peace Award. And let me just, before we get into the political crisis in Lebanon, of course, there's a lot of anticipation about whether or not Syria will be joining the Annapolis Peace Conference early next week. Do you have any indications, Rami Khoury, whether or not the Syrian delegation will show?
Well, it seems that the Syrians are going to send a deputy foreign minister. That was the latest news this afternoon. I'm not sure if they've made an official announcement yet, but that's what everybody expects. So I think it's pretty safe to expect some Syrian presence there, but not as high as the foreign minister level.
So the Americans have said that they haven't exactly laid out a red carpet, but they said we won't turn off his microphone. So who do you think he's speaking for?
The deputy foreign minister would be clearly, you know, there to show that the Syrians want to be a player, that they're not going to just boycott these gatherings. There is a consensus in the Arab world that most people in the Arab world, most governments, feel that they should be there if there is a serious attempt, even though the chances of success are slim at Annapolis. But I think most people feel that we in the Arab world don't want to be accused of being the spoilers and not exploring any possibility for peace. So the Syrians want to be there. And the Syrians, you know, they have a lot of cards to play in Lebanon and with the Palestinians, with Hamas, with Iran, with Iraq. There's many, many irons in the fire that the Syrians have. And the only really way they can capitalize on this position is by being involved in a negotiation or a gathering like this. So I think the Syrians will go.
And they tried to make the Golan Heights a condition of their showing up. In other words, putting that on the agenda. I guess the U.S. has finessed that, suggesting, well, you know, the people are free to talk about what they want to talk about.
Well, yeah, I mean, the U.S. basically said, well, it's sort of on the agenda, and the Syrians in return said, well, we're sort of there with a deputy foreign minister. I mean, you know, a deputy foreign minister isn't going to change the world, but it's better than not being there at all. So I think both the Americans and the Syrians sent signals that are commensurate in their intensity and significance, that, you know, we want to play ball, but we're not going to give in unilaterally to the other side's demands. Neither side is going to give in. And that's how diplomacy works.
So let me just turn, if I can, Ramakuri, to the situation in Lebanon, where you are. And there's reports. Robert Fisk, the British journalist who lived there for a number of decades, he has a piece in The Observer today saying darkness falls on the Middle East. In Beirut, people are moving out of their homes just as they have in Baghdad. Is it quite that dire?
Well, I think it's a serious situation. I don't think we can compare Lebanon with Baghdad, no. And there are some people who moved simply out of precaution because, you know, Lebanon has gone through tremendous problems in the last 25 years since, 30 years almost, since 75, with civil wars and internal tension and regional wars and all kinds of terrorism now. So people have learned from experience that when you get a tense situation, sometimes you take preemptive precautionary measures if you have kids in school, if you've got business interests. So some people would be moving just because they think there might be trouble down the road or a terrible stalemate is going to ensue, and this is also going to be a problem for them. So people clearly are concerned. There is a problem. There is tension. There is stress here in Lebanon, but it's not anywhere near what you're getting in Iraq, where large numbers of people are fleeing, no.
And what about I've seen pictures of billboards suggesting that we don't want to go back to the 15-year-long civil war. Explain that subtext, if you will.
Well, this has been one of the peculiar things in Lebanon in the last, say, 3 years or so since, 2.5 years, since Hariri was killed in February 2005. You've had two conflicting, contradictory trends. At one level, you've got massive expression of popular unity, national sentiment, cohesion. People want to live as one country in peace and equality and democracy, etc. They want their leaders to agree. So there's great expressions of, you know, rational, reasonable communal coexistence at the grassroots level, which is repeatedly reaffirmed, including in billboards like this, demonstrations, marches, newspaper ads, new groups being formed. At the same time, this massive expression of popular sentiment seems powerless. It doesn't have the capacity to impact on the political leadership. It has not been able to push either the government or the opposition groups towards achieving the kind of concord and agreement and consensus that the vast majority of ordinary Lebanese want. So you have both of these happening simultaneously. Sensible people at the grassroots level saying we should reach an agreement and live peacefully and happily. Political leaders who are stuck in a situation where they're evenly matched, the government and the opposition. They're both supported by foreign powers and regional powers. There's a stalemate, and neither side wants to give in, and this is why we have this tense situation.
Is that to say that the Lebanese people are hostages and pawns to outside powers?
I wouldn't put it exactly like that, because this is not a situation where the Lebanese, you know, have been innocently abused by outside powers. The Lebanese have allowed themselves, often enthusiastically, to be used by outside powers, and often have courted or even asked the outside powers to come in and help them. And this has been going on since the mid-1800s, the middle of the 19th century. So this is a problem that structurally that Lebanon has, being a system based on consensus among 18 different confessional and religious and ethnic and national groups. That consensus is achieved by local deal-making, but it's also achieved by reflecting a balance of power among regional and global players like the Syrians, the Israelis, the Iranians, the Saudis, and others in the region, as well as the Americans and the French and people further away. And that external intervention in Lebanon is something that the Lebanese themselves have been engaged in for a long time, but it's now getting a little bit out of hand, where the local people, the local Lebanese, even if they wanted to reach an agreement, in some cases they might be deterred by external influence.
Again, I'm speaking with Rami Khoury, who's the editor of, at large of the Beirut-based Daily Star, and we're talking about the political crisis in Lebanon, where a new president has not been seated. The government came out of its secure hotel for a meeting the last Friday, but nothing was achieved. At least it didn't appear to be so. And there are rumors of war, as we mentioned. And of course, this is in the context now of the broader efforts for some kind of comprehensive Middle East peace that will be talked about this coming week at Annapolis. Again, Rami Khoury, just walk us through I know that the political system is apportioned by ethnic apportionment, and that essentially the bloc of Hezbollah, supported by Iran and Syria, who have been joined by a Christian defector, if you will, Michel Aoun, essentially feel underrepresented. They've been staking out and demonstrating for the longest time. At the same time, there's been what appears to be a form of serial assassination on the part alleged to be the Syrians, starting with the killing of Hariri, and I think five Christian ministers have been killed, so they're holding on to precarious majority as a result. So give us an assessment of where things stand, if you will.
Things are really deeply stalemated. I mean, there is a combination of intense stalemate at one level, the local level, where you have both sides, the government and its supporters, which is supported by the U.S. and others, and Israel and the West and the Saudis, and you have facing them the Hezbollah-led opposition, which includes Michel Aoun, and I think the way you described him probably is not fully accurate. He's more than a defector. He's probably the single most powerful Christian leader in Lebanon. He has a very large and significant following, alliance, or whatever we call it, his working agreement program, joint program with Hezbollah, basically putting him in with Hezbollah in one camp, is a huge political development in Lebanon to have such a major Christian figure siding with Hezbollah. So you have these two sides that are very evenly matched, very determined, and what's with external support, but they're both also seeing this as an existential battle. And this is what makes it so difficult. They're afraid if either side makes a little concession that they're going to completely be not wiped out, but they will completely lose their rightful role and influence in the political power system. And they see this as, which is accurate, I think, they both see this as part of a wider battle, an ideological battle going on in the Middle East, which is to define whether the Middle East broadly becomes a more Western American-oriented kind of place or a more Middle Eastern, Islamic, Syrian, Iranian-oriented kind of place. This is a huge ideological battle, and the epicenter of it now, or at least the symbolic epicenter, is downtown Beirut, where you have this confrontation, a peaceful confrontation, to be sure. People are not fighting, but there's a lot of political tension, and no side is willing to give way or to budge or to make concessions. There's intense mediation. I mean, there's more mediation going on here, I think, than anywhere in the history of the modern diplomatic world. The number of international mediators and Arab mediators and local mediators is unbelievable, and none of them have been able to make a breakthrough. So it's a real dilemma. The Lebanese are very frustrated, and now the immediate issue, of course, is to choose a new president. But behind that, you have power sharing in the cabinet, in the government. You have calling a new election, a new electoral system, all kinds of other issues that will come up. So even if they do choose a president, they will have all these other underlying issues that they're going to have to grapple with. So most people now feel that Lebanon is not going to slip into civil war. I think that's very clear that both sides have had many chances to fight if they wanted to, and nobody wants to do that. They've had the civil war. They didn't learn it. They didn't gain anything from it. They learned a lot about the futility of civil war, and they don't want to do it again. So there's a political battle now instead, and this is something that most Lebanese are very frustrated about. And they also are realizing that it's not economically sustainable. This cannot go on for years and years and years. But there is a sense that they're going to have to come up with a new power-sharing system that does give Hezbollah and Aoun and the opposition more of a share of power, which is, I think most people concede that that is a reasonable thing, because they do represent a big percentage of the people, maybe half the people. But they need to come up with that power-sharing formula in a way that doesn't also make the government, the Christian, many of the Christian groups, the pro-Saudi, pro-American, pro-Western groups, feel that their country has now been turned into another Iran or Syria. So finding that balance is the real tricky part.
Mm-hmm. And the immediate issue is that the outgoing president, the pro-Syrian president, the battle over is over whether or not he'll be replaced by a similarly sympathetic president, similarly sympathetic to Syria, or less sympathetic and more sympathetic to the pro-Western government that's hanging on by its fingernails. Roughly speaking, you've got the other Christian group, the Falangists, and others who support the West and the United States. Then you've got the Syrian and Iranian-supported Shiite groups, Amal and Hezbollah. And when you get to, I mentioned Michel Aoun. What is his motive then? I mean, imagine when I use the word defector, I imagine a lot of the conservative Christians feel that he is a traitor. So what is his motive? Is he just looking at the long term, saying, you know, we've got to live together and this is the future and you can't ignore a third of the people?
Well, you know, Michel Aoun was a real hero to a lot of Lebanese, including most of the Christians, when he was actively confronting the Syrians, when the Syrians dominated and controlled Lebanon for so many years until 2005. He fought them here. He was forced into exile. He was based in Paris. He continued to confront them. He was the only one really speaking out forcefully against the Syrian domination of Lebanon when everybody else in Lebanon was afraid to do so. So he came back to Lebanon really as a triumphant figure. It seems, though, that power has gone to his head, and he's got a bit of a megalomaniacal problem in the views of many analysts here in Lebanon, who see him as wanting to be president so badly that he will do anything to do that. He's not really a pro-Syrian as in the way that some other people in Lebanon are close to Syria. He's just willing to play the political game in a more pragmatic way. To get power for him to become president. But he is also a man who has a program. He's unusual in that he's not an ethnically based or a sectarian based figure. The Christians are his predominant supporters, but he doesn't have a tradition of a kind of a fiefdom or a warlord type tribal allegiance like some of the other Christian leaders do. He does present himself as somebody who actually offers a program for the reform of the Lebanese government and economy and society and security based on certain principles. And this is one of the reasons why he's attractive, not just because he challenged the Syrians. He did represent, and still does to some extent, a new form of modern politics based on offering citizens and voters a program, a policy program, with things that are attractive to them, like security, development, equality, democracy, lack of corruption, that kind of thing. So he's a very mixed figure. He's got a lot of strong points, which is why he's popular, but he also has some obvious weak ones, the main one being that his ego seems to be often getting in the way of his practical politics. But he has to be dealt with. You can't just ignore him. He's a powerful figure. And I think a lot of these issues, by the way, in Lebanon now, when you're talking about Hezbollah or Michel Aoun or others, these issues may change depending on what happens in Annapolis. If you suddenly get a Syrian-American rapprochement, for instance, this could change the whole equation. If you suddenly get a Syrian-Israeli peace negotiation over the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, you can get a completely new set of principles and power relationships defining the Syrian presence in Lebanon or vis-a-vis the Palestinians, vis-a-vis Israel, vis-a-vis Iraq, the U.S., Iran. All of these could change if the wider regional situation changes. And this is why people in Lebanon now are basically sort of on pause and on hold to see what comes out of Annapolis.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, and we indeed will be holding our breath. And clearly, the Saudis are very unhappy with the Syrians, and they would, and they're apparently funding a new security force on the for the Sunni minority there in Lebanon. And the broader picture that you just pointed out, that rather optimistically, that may come out of Annapolis, may be bringing Syria back into the fold, and Saudi money will play a huge part in that. Plus, I think in the rebuilding of Palestine, if that's a possibility.
Right. These are all issues that we have to keep our eye on. And I mean, Syria and Iran are both major players that are portrayed in the West, especially in the U.S., as just the epitome of evil, bad guys, you know, to support terrorism, they support weapons of mass destruction, proliferation, and all kinds of things. The reality is they're much more complicated than that. They have real interests, real assets in the region. They do good things, they do bad things. And like any group like this, they've got to be engaged, just like the U.S. engaged the Russians and the now is engaging the North Koreans. I think the U.S. has to do the same thing. So Syria and Iran both have to be looked at very carefully, and relationships with them will define a lot of what happens in Lebanon and Palestine and other places.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Rami Khoury.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Rami Khoury, who is the editor-at-large for the Beirut-based Daily Star. I'm now speaking with Dr. Chris Fair, who was a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, where she specialized in South Asian political and military affairs. She is now a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, and she just returned from Afghanistan, where she was a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan. And just let's begin, if we can, Chris Fair, with Afghanistan, since you were just there. There's a number of reports coming out. There's a piece by Barnett Rubin, who's a specialist on Afghanistan, rather pessimistic, speaking about the recent bombing of Syed Mustafa Kazemi, the former Minister of Commerce, who was an important political figure in the government of Afghanistan, being a representative of the Shiite minority. And he was killed along with a bunch of schoolchildren and others in a pretty savage bombing, which is not, many people don't think, it, in fact, was the Taliban. There are various suspects, Hekmatyar and Al-Qaeda and others have come to mind. How significant was that killing of the ministers?
Well, I think it's important probably along a number of dimensions. The first, as you noted, there's a lot of suspicion about the nature of this attack. It doesn't really fit the portfolio or the profile of Taliban-led suicide attacks. When I was at UNAMA, my primary goal or mission was the co-editing and co-authoring of UNAMA's suicide bombing reports. And when you look at the data across all of the attacks perpetrated by the Taliban, you find that they generally don't target what we would call leadership targets, leaving aside apex leaders like Karzai. Mostly they go after the Afghan National Police, the Afghan National Army, and, of course, foreign military forces. And when they do conduct their operations, unlike this attack, they tend to be not very effective. The average victim yield, i.e. the number of persons killed per bomber, is only about three. So both in terms of the kind of attack, its lethality, the targeting employed, raises a lot of questions about who did this. And, you know, as someone who studies terrorism in this region, I'm always concerned about sort of what you, I guess you could call competitive violence when you have a technique, in this case suicide attacks, that are being used by multiple perpetrators. Because what happens, they tend to have a pressure put upon them to sort of outcompete the others that are using this technique. So it certainly raises a lot of questions about who did this and what motives. It also raises a number of questions about the nature of the threat that the Afghan government confronts, as well as the coalition forces.
In this particular rather hideous event, there were, of course, six parliamentarians killed, 59 schoolchildren, and several others, including teachers. Apparently, as well as the fatalities from the bomb, apparently the Afghan guards shot wildly into the crowd. Do you have any sense of how that happened, or what that?
Well, I mean, we know how it happened.
Afghan
police are, you know, they're undertrained, they're not terribly competent, and they likely overreacted. What we don't know, and indeed what we can't know, is how many of those individuals died because of the suicide attack versus how many died because of the police firing. The reason for this is, and this is something that we talked about in the UNAMA report.
UNAMA being the group that you just worked for,
exactly.
United Nations Assistance Mission
to Afghanistan. It's unfortunate but true that they tend not to do autopsies. So the victims were buried almost immediately. One of the things that you put into a suicide bomb, of course, are ball bearings. And ball bearings ripping through a body, unless you do an autopsy, you can't really tell what the projectile was that went ripping through someone's body. So was it bullets fired by a panicked police, or was it shrapnel from the bomb? Unless you were to do an autopsy, you wouldn't know. And I was at a meeting last week in Brussels, and I had a chance to talk to my former UNAMA colleagues, and I posed the same question. And they were dismayed because it would be useful, obviously, to know who died and under what causes, it for no other reason than to deal with the, for lack of a better word, the PR aspects of this. But since they didn't do autopsies, we're never going to know what the fatality breakdown is by the various means that by which death occurred.
So was this a result of incompetence, a cover-up, or the Islamic strictures on quick burial?
No, this is not particular to this case. Mm-hmm. This is actually an ongoing problem. When I was doing the work for the UNAMA suicide attack report, what I had found is it's not only just the victims. They actually don't do proper investigations into the perpetrators of the attack either. And this is very unfortunate. So we have very good data about where the attack occurred, how it occurred, i.e. body-borne versus vehicle-borne versus other kinds of bomb delivery. But we actually know very little about the actual perpetrators of the attack. So the problem with investigations, it is pervasive. It probably does have to do with, as you noted, rules about when you bury someone. I remember I was there when King Zahir Shah was returned to Afghanistan, and there was quite a bit of flap. You know, they, of course, had to violate that rule so that they could have proper observation for the king. So this is certainly an issue. But I also want to point out that the Afghan authorities simply don't have the capabilities to do autopsies. In the training of the police, what you find is that because they are frontline forces in many ways and they're used in military operations, the police are really being trained to really become sort of a paramilitary force. And what you find is, you know, after working with the U.S. and the other international actors on police reform and police training, they don't really have investigative capabilities, and that's going to be a long ways off. So it's not a cover-up. It's a combination of social expectations about proper dealing with the deceased, but it's also about a much larger set of issues that they simply lack the capacity to do the kinds of investigations that are needed.
So does this then get to the heart of the problem here in Afghanistan following this, the successful intervention after 9/11, albeit that bin Laden got away, but most of the Taliban were either killed or driven out of the country. And for a while there, the U.S., in fact, the U.S. was so confident, I think, that they gave NATO the back of their hand, and then later when they got in trouble, then they invited NATO back in. But the long and the short of it is, many people think that this whole operation in Afghanistan has been the resurgence of the Taliban, if you will, as they've taken advantage of Washington's distraction with Iraq and Islamabad, Pakistan's collusion. So is that what's going on? In other words, why have...
Well, Ian, that's a pretty loaded question. I'm not, you know, as a RAN employee, I can't accept the premise of that question. But I think that we should probably, you know, fold back a little bit you know, what it is that you're trying to get at. It is true that in 2004, people were ready to write the obituary of the Taliban, and they came back fighting in a very big way in 2005. And they were using new tactics that had not previously been observed. What had also become apparent by 2005 was that the Taliban did have access to sanctuary in Pakistan. Now, of course, the question, and this is the sort of thing that drives Islamabad insane, whether or not the most aggressive of the assertions is true, that is to say that the ISI actually nurtures the Taliban, you know, there's no smoking gun for that. And you'll talk to all sorts of people in various governments that have various evidence that unfortunately cannot be discussed, or so they say, in an open source environment. So you've got this problem where they say data exists, but they can't talk about it. So the most grandiose of those claims that Pakistani armed forces or components thereof actively support the Taliban is really hard to prove. But what's not hard to prove is that they do enjoy sanctuary in various parts of the tribal areas. And work that RAND's done, work that others have done, shows that it's very difficult, it's much harder to defeat an insurgency when they enjoy sanctuary in another state than when they don't. So what certainly came to the fore in 2005 is the Taliban really rallied. They came back with new resources, they came back with new recruits, they came back with new techniques. Now, one of the interesting things about the Taliban resurgence in 2005 is that it really, I think, revealed really structural problems with the way in which the Taliban had been dealt with. You know, there's only 41,000 troops in Afghanistan. And while that may sound like a reasonable number, in fact, fewer than half of them are what you'd call fighting troops. So let me break this down for you. So for the Germans, who are up in the north, they're doing police training. They're not allowed to accompany their trainees into environments where they might take fire. So what you actually find is that in many of the troops there are restrictions. So, for example, some of the contributing nations won't let their troops be used outside of Kabul, for example. So when you actually look at that 41,000, how many of them are fighting, you really see it's a small number. And one thing I really got an appreciation for, having spent some time there and in the conduct of that research, got to see a good part of the country, is that it's really difficult to explain how challenging that terrain is. It is mountain upon mountain upon mountain. So you have a very weak force structure in Afghanistan. And by the way, this is why many operators will opine that they have to rely upon these airstrikes, which, as a consequence, the U.S. and ISAF have killed as many civilians as the Taliban because of the way in which they may talk about precision-guided munitions, but the fact is they do have collateral damage. So this is certainly a problem on the Afghan side. On the Pakistan side, you have a very unfortunate negative feedback loop whereby everyone in Afghanistan knows there's different kinds of sanctuary pursued in different parts of Fatah. And the Pakistanis have been our partner in fighting the war on terrorism. They began conducting military operations there in 2004. And what they found was that they were not militarily capable of defeating this insurgency. And there are a number of reasons why, but they initially went in there with a paramilitary outfit called the Frontier Corps. They were the desirable first operators because they were local. They were locally recruited. They knew the language. They knew the population terrain. You know, in some sense, that's been an utter disaster because they know that if they were to shoot a miscreant, as Musharraf calls them, that they may be initiating a blood feud. He may come home and find his family massacred. So while they were, at first blush, the most obvious people to deploy, they were also the most compromised and, I have to say, just fearful of actually engaging mm-hmm. this enemy. So there are a number of factors that have to do with this particular theater. The larger point that you raise about being distracted by operations in Iraq, you know, this is not something that I terribly have a lot of insight into, but what I can say is looking at the way in which the Pakistan and the Afghanistan relationship has been managed, there's a lot of reasons for very strong criticism. And there are a lot of people that will simply say, you know, outright that this conflict in Afghanistan is winnable, but it's not winnable with the current force disposition and the current priorities that are apparent in Afghanistan, and I might add in Pakistan.
Well, of course, that very stark choice, if you will, was made by the former NATO commander before he, the British commander before he left, saying that we could lose this and we should win it, but we can lose it. And you were talking earlier about the police, the inadequacy of the trained police. So where does that stand in terms of? I thought that was the biggest need for, on the part of the NATO and the United States was to train a police and Afghan National Army. And well, yet it looks like NATO and the United States is bearing the brunt of all the fighting.
Well, actually, the guys who are bearing the brunt of it, you know, if you look at the fatalities of the Afghan National Police, they're really out there. They're very exposed. Because they are so exposed, they are frequently targeted. They are soft targets. You know, obviously they're hard targets in the big picture, but of all the hard targets, they are the softest. They have thin-skinned vehicles. They don't have protective gear. They have inadequate equipment. They travel in large numbers, so when there are attacks, they tend to be, they tend to be killed in large numbers. The problem that one confronts, it's not just police training. If one looked at the history of Afghanistan, it has never, in its entire existence, paid for itself. It has always been what one could call a rentier state. Before the Taliban and post-Taliban period, what one finds is that the strategic elite sitting there basically made deals. They rented out their strategic import to the British, to the Russians, and basically they sold themselves as a buffer between two empires. And if you were to go back and look at old budget data, going back, and the budget data, you can find budget data for hundreds of years, it never paid for itself. The Brits, during the days of the British Raj, paid for the court, it paid for it just gave them outright weapons. Of course, the Russians increasingly played a role in that in the 20th century. So you never had a country that could pay for its own defense. You never had a functioning police force. So one of my big picture concerns is that we often talk about pay. Everyone knows that the Taliban pays better than anyone else except maybe poppy runners. So you can talk about increasing the police pay versus the ANA pay, and there's a reason for that. Some people have argued the police actually are killed in larger numbers than the Afghan National Army, so therefore they should be paid more. You can talk about the inequities that then imposes upon the rest of the pay schedule for civil servants, but that's really missing the big picture. Are we, the international community, basically committing ourselves to in perpetuity paying for this state? Because what we're currently building is a bureaucracy that no Afghan government has ever been able to pay for, and certainly not going forward. It has never been able to extract the resources necessary to cover its own expenses.
And Dr. Crisfield, just you mentioned the poppy running. There's a fairly widespread concern that it isn't a narco state, and that this year the opium crops expanded by 40%. There's some talk about apparently the European governments and the British have been urging the United States to consider buying the entire crop. That, of course, runs up against the war on drugs in terms of our kind of thinking here in the United States. We're talking about chemical spraying. So what's the practicality?
It's not just war on drugs, though, Ian. I mean, the problem with that is that you have a pretty huge moral hazard problem. One, the states that currently have a legalized poppy growing business, so India's in there, Australia's in there, Turkey's in there, they'd have to agree. And there is the whole issue of price setting. And so the whole idea of buying up what is right now the world's largest producer of opium and trying to then put that into the market, the legal opium market, there are just a number of economic issues that suggest it may not be viable. And certainly, the countries that currently have the legal right, I mean, this would could obviously have the impact of driving those prices down. And the current countries that produce it legally, Australia, India, Turkey, I think there are a few others, they have a much more efficient production system. Afghanistan still uses the manpower-intensive lansing. So there are some pretty economically significant things that need to be looked at. The other concern is that you don't want to create an incentive structure where other individuals decide that it's more lucrative to just start growing poppy, because basically what you're saying is that we're going to guarantee you some source of income. So you grow this, you'll definitely be able, you may not get the best price, but you're going to get a price. You're not going to starve. So you create an incentive for non-poppy growing areas to begin growing poppy. And this is a concern in a country like Afghanistan because there is no alternative market. So opponents of that are weary, and I think rightly so, about a policy that what basically creates what economists call moral hazard. You're encouraging them to engage in an activity which in the long run sort of undermines elements that we're trying to build up.
So, now, so what's the alternative then, given that nobody's particularly happy with the status quo, and quite often analysts in this country say that the Taliban itself is behind the drug trade?
Yeah, well, you know, this is very rapidly veering into areas beyond my expertise, and I'm not a fan of speaking, you know, on mm-hmm. topics about which I'm not terribly informed. But I do know that the empirics of the extent to which the Taliban make money off of poppy, or the percentage of their income derived from poppy, those empirics are certainly disputed. But I think from my point of view, having spent, again, some time in Afghanistan, I think what I came back fairly dismayed by is that there's a lot of focus on I guess what you would call micro-solutions. So in other words, decisions based upon the farmer. And those are, of course, very important because it's essentially the farmer's decisions that you're trying to influence. Now, but the fact is, the farmer makes his decisions based in a number of contexts. I mean, they don't own their own land. Many of them are tenant farmers. And you can sort of fold back. And I think the layer of analysis that I've been very dismayed by is that whether your desired empirically supportable outcome is spraying, whether it's buying up the crop, it doesn't deal with this basic fact, okay? When you hang out in Afghanistan, everyone knows the rumors about two brothers of President Karzai mm-hmm. And their involvement in the, they're both Kandahar-based, and their involvement. Everyone knows that there are very particular governors all the way from Badakhshan down to Nimruz that are appointed by the president or through a process which he oversees, who are intimately involved in growing poppy. Everyone knows that chiefs of police are involved in this process. So you can focus on whatever outcome or whatever process you'd like to focus on. But the larger issue is, why are so many of Afghanistan's strategic elites vested in being a narco state? And until one can deal with their cost-benefit calculus and motivate them to want to be something other than beneficiaries of a narco state, all of these stratagems are going to fail.
Hmm.
Period. So whether you talk about aerial spraying, whether you talk about crop substitution, these are like rearranging deck chairs, as they say, on the Titanic, because the larger issue, from my point of view, is the direct beneficiaries of the narco trade, and they are, in many cases, the state strategic elite. And we are unwilling to say so. Now, you know, maybe for good reason. You know, it's speculative about Karzai's brothers. But it's not speculative in some sense when you have, in the case of one governor, who's got poppy growing in the backyard of the governor's palace. So there needs to be some way of dealing with how do we affect change when the strategic elites themselves are not necessarily interested in change. This, to me, is the biggest question. And no one will really take it on because it is so, you know, obviously problematic.
Well, Christopher, we got off on a fascinating discussion there about Afghanistan. We didn't even get to Pakistan.
So maybe you
consider that. Maybe you're grateful for that. I thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. Thank you, Ian. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Chris Fair, who was until recently a senior research associate at the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She's now a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, and she just returned from Afghanistan, where she was a political officer with the United Nations Assistant Mission to Afghanistan. I'm now speaking with Dr. Benjamin Barber, who is a distinguished senior fellow at DEMOS, the New York Progressive Think Tank for Ideas and Action. He is the author of the prescient book Jihad versus McWorld, and his new book is Consumed: How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. And of course, last Friday was Black Friday, the biggest shopping day of the year. And Ben Barber, I had the misfortune of watching local news over the weekend. And you perhaps understand why we don't have a political culture in this country, and why citizens are so uninformed, because the entire news broadcast for a half an hour on local news was about shopping and about consumering. And at the end of the day, there was no question that the implication was that going to the mall is an act of patriotism.
Well, you're right, Ian, and happy Thanksgiving, or happy post-Thanksgiving, although we haven't got much left of Thanksgiving, because Black Friday's been backing up into Thanksgiving Thursday now, and a lot of stores have actually started opening not just at 4 in the morning on Friday morning, but actually staying open on Thanksgiving and urging people not to eat turkey but to come and shop instead. So we're kind of losing our Thanksgiving altogether. But you're right, it's not just that there's this ongoing discussion and even celebration of shopping, but it's almost entirely uncritical. There's no context, there's no sense of asking the question whether this is really appropriate, whether we want to live in a society like that, whether we want our kids to grow up in a society like that. And to the extent there is discussion, I got a call on Black Friday from a radio station in San Francisco that asks me the following question: what's wrong with consumers? Why do they love shopping so much? What's wrong with Americans that they're such ardent shoppers? The assumption being that this whole phenomenon is demand-side driven, pull-side driven, that the retail industry would be happy to close down for the long Thanksgiving weekend to not sell a lot of things, but American consumers insist on being 24/7 shoppers, and that therefore it's really a demand-side, not a supply-side phenomenon. And that's, you know, looking back, you just talked about the narco state in Afghanistan with your guest, and that would be like pretending that drugs are exclusively a demand side. It's just that so many people want to do drugs that leads the poor folks of Afghanistan and Colombia and elsewhere to produce what they want without paying any attention to the supply side, the push side, what the corporations and companies and states that benefit and profit from this profligate behavior gain from it. And that's very much the case, I think, in the United States, that to the extent we think about it at all, other than just celebrate shopping, we tend to think about it as there must be something wrong with Americans, something wrong with parents who let their kids be targeted and so on, rather than asking the question, what has happened to modern capitalism that it insists not on manufacturing goods to meet our needs, but manufacturing needs to sell a host and cornucopia of irrelevant and unnecessary goods that we neither need nor want? That, to me, is the central question that goes unasked.
Well, indeed, just to touch on what you mentioned about the corruption of Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is always it's certainly my favorite, and it's such an American, uniquely American experience. And at the same time, and of course, there's no people don't exchange Hallmark cards, and they don't give gifts, and that's many. And in fact, they celebrate family. It is truly something that is to be admired. And the idea that it's being corrupted and the stores are opening at midnight is pretty depressing. But what happened to the boycott that was supposed to take place?
Well, the problem is, again, there are a few ardent and zealous advocates of non-shopping, or at least less shopping and so on, but, you know, they're up against a multi-billion-dollar marketing and advertising industry, and it's very hard for a few zealous individuals who say, gosh, shouldn't we have pluralistic lives where maybe we spend a couple days without shopping, particularly, as you say, on a Thanksgiving that's supposed to be devoted to non-commercial familial get-togethers and giving of thanks for what it is that we have. And what's really happened, I think, to Thanksgiving is that because it's kind of a holiday where people don't have to work, the retail industry suddenly realizes what a great time to get a couple of free shopping days for Christmas. So Thanksgiving has really become the run-up to Christmas, and when the big Christmas rush of shopping starts, and rather than saying, let's leave people alone, not just on Thanksgiving, but for the whole Thanksgiving weekend, so we can have 3 or 4 days with our families pursuing things that don't involve spending money or going to the mall. Instead, it says, oh my gosh, here's 3 or 4 empty days where people aren't working, and they've got time on their hands, and why spend it loving their relatives and giving thanks for their blessings when instead they can be in the mall shopping for Christmas?
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Benjamin Barber, the author of Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. And I mentioned at the beginning, Ben Barber, about watching the local news, which was entirely devoted to consumption. And of course, the people who own the media, and of course the media is increasingly becoming hostage to a few moguls, and the FCC is in fact trying to give away more of the store to fewer and fewer of these media moguls like Sumner Redstone and Rupert Murdoch. There's no question that the media in this company, the people that own the media, would like to have wall-to-wall commercials, because commercials are revenue for them, and the content that they have to pay for is an expense. And we see that happening to our television. So it seems to me that that's the real nexus. The salesman for the consumer society is in fact the television, and the of course newspapers entirely depend on their revenue, almost entirely from advertising. So there's the knot, the Gordian knot, isn't there?
Well, no question about it, Ian, because whatever quaint antique notions we once had of the press and the media as a fourth estate to help us keep our government honest, to keep us informed, to help our children grow educationally and culturally, today the media, because they are wholly owned subsidiaries of large profit-making corporations that have to meet their bottom line and provide good profits for their shareholders, are completely dependent on what they make, and that means they've got to turn news, information, education, and culture into commodities, into products for sale. So they are not only the instrument of selling other corporations' goods, they are themselves, as it were, selling commodities. And everything they sell, whether it's news or entertainment or education or culture, has to be understood as a commodity that people will pay for, so that it too has become part of it. It's just like politics. I mean, our politicians, in a sense, have become commodities too, and political campaigns are merchandising campaigns, and the people who actually run the campaigns are often people from the marketing and the polling and the merchandising industries, who are perfectly content to sell candidates the way they sell iPhones, and there's little to distinguish the two, in fact, nowadays.
So you're really not only is has Thanksgiving been corrupted, now we're entering the political season, albeit pushed forward by these early primaries, and the entire, of course, once they select the candidates, which they will do much earlier this time probably, the entire spring and summer will be the television campaigns. Campaigns will be fought out on television, which means millions and billions of dollars spent on television. And so, in effect, what our political system has become is a kind of welfare revolving door for the media companies, because the candidates raise their money from the special interests and then turn it over to the television moguls.
Well, that's right. It's even worse, Ian, because think about this. The airwaves belong to the American people. They are, by definition, public. They can't be belong to any individual. The government once took responsibility for that and then licensed and, in effect, sold the airwaves to private companies who now sell it back to us, the public, who really own it at these extravagant prices. One of the reasons there's so much money in politics is that 60 to 70% of every campaign goes for radio and television advertising, which should be free. Our candidates should be able to go on our public airwaves and compete with one another for free. But because our government has, in effect, given away the licenses and privatized the airwaves, we now have to buy back the airwaves at these exorbitant prices, and that, of course, turns the whole thing into a commodity beauty contest and the kind of horse races which we see and makes this difficult. By the way, I want to be very clear about one thing, because I'm not a fanatic. I'm not someone who says, don't shop. Materialism is awful. We are, among other things, material beings. We need to shop. We need to acquire things. But my problem is not with shopping, but shopping 24/7. My problem is not with advertising, but advertising everywhere. My problem is not with marketing, but marketing is the primary obsession of the entire capitalist industry. It's that deformation, that kind of deranging of capitalism that actually has thrown capitalism off the track and taken it away from the thing it really does very well, which is to look at the world, see what's necessary, see what people want and need, and then produce goods and services to meet those needs, and on the way to doing that, solve problems, give people what they need, and at the same time make a profit for the entrepreneurs who figure that out. That's the way it originally worked, which is why there was this nice kind of Protestant ethos associated with earlier capitalism, where things like saving, deferred gratification, hard work, celebration of service and helping other people was kind of built through the Protestant ethic into capitalist enterprise. And that's why America, perhaps as the Puritan Republic, also became the first kind of capitalist republic that combined those two things.
But nowadays,
when we are, on the contrary, in a situation where we are manufacturing not goods to meet real needs, but manufacturing needs to sell all the goods we have, you have not an ethos of Protestantism and service and hard work, but a ethos of infantilism, of impetuous behavior, of gimme, 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 I want it now. And the retail industry, capitalism itself, promotes that to try to stay alive.
Well, just in closing, it's obvious that our capitalists have failed us. Detroit can't make a decent car. We are in an age of capitalism here in America where the package is more important than the product, because they're able to sell deficient movies, they're able to sell deficient cars. Why can't they make decent movies and decent cars? I guess that's a discussion for another day.
But the bottom line here is that capitalism needs to be fixed. It needs to go back to producing real goods and services for those two-thirds of the world's people who still have real needs, and where both money's to be made and service and goods can be made that will do that. And so we have to, in effect, fix capitalism and make it work properly.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Benjamin Barber.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking with Ben Barber, the author of a new book, Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong and Lick Duan, the assistant producers, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.